Well, welcome to our studio here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mears. Thanks for joining us. Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are set to hold another round of talks aimed at reviving the accord in Vienna. The joint commission will be attended by representatives from Iran, Britain, China, France, Germany, Russia, and the EU. The U.S. Special Representative for Iran, Robert Malley, is also present at the Austrian capital, but there will be no talks between him and Iranian negotiators. Earlier, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the nuclear talks were in, quote, an unclear place, but admitted that the sides have shown serious willingness to take a pathway back into the deal. That is, while Tehran has repeatedly said that it would only accept the outcome of the talks once Washington removes all sanctions in a verifiable manner. Iran has also made it clear that it would not allow the negotiations to become attritional. The U.S. has formally begun withdrawing its remaining troops from Afghanistan. American helicopters were seen flying over Kabul and nearby Bagram Air Base as Washington geared up the pullout process. U.S. officials also confirmed the troop withdrawal, saying that May 1st is just a continuation. American forces were scheduled to leave by May 1st under a deal signed between the Taliban and the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump. The Taliban accuses Washington of violating the agreement. However, the incumbent President Joe Biden has promised to end what he called the Forever War. He has declared all troops will be out of Afghanistan by September. The U.S. invaded the country in 2001 with its so-called War on Terror slogan, but despite two decades of its presence, the U.S. failed to quell violence and ensure security in the war-torn country. Amin Alami says the U.S. troop withdrawal will leave the Taliban without the slogan of fighting foreign occupiers that they used to justify their attacks.
It seems that with the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan, there will be no place for many issues or slogans for the Taliban, mainly for jihad, because there would be no foreign invader or there would be no foreign occupier. That is why the Afghan government and mainly the people of Afghanistan call on the Taliban to say yes to the demands of the people, that is bringing peace and stability via launching a direct negotiations between the main local players.
The UN Human Rights Office says it is disturbed by Bahraini police's use of force against a peaceful sit-in in the kingdom's main prison. A spokesperson of the organization called the violent repression in the notorious Jow prison unnecessary and misappropriate. She called on the Bahraini government to immediately launch a thorough and effective investigation into the incident. Prisoners started their sit-in on April 5 after the death of a political prisoner who was reportedly denied timely access to essential health care. Activists say security forces used heavy-handed tactics against prisoners, beating and injuring them. The Bahraini regime faces criticisms over the situation of its prisons amid the coronavirus crisis. The appalling prison situation has also sparked protests among the families of the detainees. Palestinians have held a mass rally in the besieged Gaza Strip to voice their support for ongoing protests in the occupied West Bank and to condemn the Israeli crackdown on Palestinians. Ruba Akram reports from Gaza.
Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets in the Gaza Strip after the Friday prayers in solidarity with Jerusalem al-Quds and its people. The Hamas movement organized the mass rally. The protesters slammed the acts of violence done by Israeli forces in Jerusalem al-Quds and expressed solidarity with Palestinians in the occupied territories.
Jerusalem al-Quds has always been our main cause of conflict and the destination of all the resistance and revolutions. We will not accept the Israeli regime's attempts to Judaize al-Quds by expelling and killing its people and demolishing their houses. Al-Quds is known for its brave men and women.
We are here to stress on our support to protesters in Jerusalem al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque and to tell them that we are here feeling what they feel and we will be all gathered to liberate Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds. I call on the international community to stand by our people in Al-Aqsa and support them against the inhumane Israeli regime.
The mass rally in Gaza, which occurred for a second Friday in a row, was triggered by Israeli restrictions on Palestinian worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque and the regime's crackdown on protesters against the restrictions. The protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed not to remain silent to the Israeli aggression against their brothers and sisters.
This is a message to our people in Jerusalem al-Quds that we will keep supporting and defending you against the Israeli occupation. We won't sit idle until seeing Al-Aqsa free and raising the flags of Palestine in Al-Quds. We are all united on the road of resistance against this occupation.
Palestinians consider resistance as the only way to respond to all Israeli violations and a key to liberating the occupied Palestinian territories.
People here in the Gaza Strip stress on their support to Palestinians in the holy city of Jerusalem al-Quds. They say they are ready to sacrifice themselves in order to defend the integrity of Palestine. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
India set yet another global record in its daily coronavirus cases, registering more than 400,000 infections, as hospitals are running out of beds, oxygen, and vaccines. The Federal Health Ministry also reported a record 3,500-plus fatalities in the past 24 hours, bringing the country's total death toll to over 211,000. The Asian nation has seen an alarming rise in cases and deaths since mid-April. Its total caseload now stands at over 19 million, second only to the U.S. On Saturday, the country expanded its vaccination drive to all adults, despite many states reporting to be running out of stocks. Until now, only frontline workers like medical staff, people over 45, and those with existing illnesses have been inoculated. Hospitals and healthcare facilities have been overwhelmed with patients. Our New Delhi correspondent Munawar Zaman says the vaccination rollout is not well managed and has drawn large-scale criticism of the government.
The vaccination drive that was rolled out has completely failed because the vaccination was not rolled out in a proper or in a well-managed or well-mannered way, because there were lots of gaps and lots of issues with the vaccination drive. When the government said that they will start vaccinating a certain age group of people and the frontline workers, etc., it has drawn a large-scale criticism, because if we remember, when the country started vaccinating its population, it also started exporting the vaccination, which many believe was the biggest setback the country is facing right now. Well, last October, when the country thought that the virus is retreating, they started thinking that we will be the first nation to export vaccination to most of the countries. But what is right now the biggest trouble and the biggest challenge for the government is the vaccination, because they don't have the vaccine shots right now. Till now, only 9% of the population has been vaccinated.
Well, the second wave of coronavirus pandemic continues to inflict mayhem in the Indian subcontinent. The country is battling with acute shortage of oxygen and medical supplies. The country has registered a record with more than 400,000 new cases and 3,500 new deaths. Munawar Zaman has more from New Delhi.
This is not a car parking, neither a hospital nor an ambulance waiting area, but a makeshift oxygen canteen organized by a Sikh Gurdwara in a posh South Delhi region. Here, oxygen is served free of cost for those in need for a mouthful of air. The second wave of the COVID-19 is turning lethal in India with each passing day, raising fears of more intense calamity in the coming weeks.
I don't know whose fault this is, Mr. Kejriwal's or Mr. Modi's, but you can never clap with one hand. They both have to be responsible for what is happening in New Delhi. You know there is no value for life here. A minister or a VIP will get oxygen, but a common man die.
The total number of infections has risen to nearly 18 million based on government data, but experts argue the numbers are much higher, and so are the fatalities. They accuse the government of hiding the actual picture, calling it an unprecedented calamity. It's not just the oxygen or medical supplies that are running short. Crematoriums are overflowing with COVID victims, and the families have to wait for hours to burn the bodies. Experts say the next 10 days are extremely critical for the country, as the outbreak might reach its peak. India's crumbling vaccination program has vastly been criticized, with health experts saying the drive was largely mismanaged and should have been rolled out for all, regardless of the age group. Critics also say the government's overconfidence in handling the first wave, costing and exporting the vaccination left the country in chaos. Now the world's biggest vaccine producer doesn't have enough stock to vaccinate its own population. Reports say only 9% of the people have been vaccinated so far.
No beds and no oxygen and proper supply is a complete crumbling down of the health system in India with, very mismanaged systems in hospital, main hospitals like AIMS in Delhi.
The Indian government is facing unprecedented criticism over handling the crisis. Critics blame the government for allowing huge election rallies and religious gatherings, which they say added fuel to the pandemic. The country's Supreme Court on Friday directed all states against clamping down on social media, as the desperate citizens have resorted to social media for grievances. Many are also posting SOS messages for the ambulances, oxygen and medicine. The top court has further directed the government to follow the national immunization model. Moreover, the international aid has started pouring in, but experts say it's just a drop in an ocean, considering the size and population of the country. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
As India grapples with COVID-19 crisis, Kashmir has also seen an unprecedented surge in COVID cases, prompting authorities to impose lockdowns in the region. Said Ali Safni has more in the following report from Indian-controlled Kashmir.
In the middle of the holy month of Ramadan, the historic Jama Mosque in Srinagar, the capital city of Indian-administered Kashmir, wears a deserted look. So are the other religious places across the region. Amid rapid surge in COVID cases, the religious bodies here have suspended congregational prayers and other religious gatherings.
We should understand the present situation. We request everyone to offer prayers at home instead of going to mosques. In this holy month, let's all pray for those affected by this virus and for an end to the pandemic.
Authorities in Kashmir have imposed lockdown to curb a surge in COVID infections and deaths. The announcement to impose lockdown came after the region recorded 700% increase in active COVID infections in this month alone, sending the alarm bells ringing. Officials have already banned gathering of more than 4 people, but essential services have been exempted from the lockdown. Authorities claim that there is no shortage of oxygen, medicines and COVID vaccine in the region, saying the government is handling the COVID situation effectively. But some people blame authorities for their late response to the pandemic.
There was no robust system of testing at the airport, at the Srinagar airport. And the biggest problem in our case was that the government and the administration here threw open Tulip Garden and organized other Khelo programs, mass gatherings, fashion shows. So this was to showcase normalcy. And in the process, what happened that from 50 odd cases per day, now we are here where we have more than 3,000 cases on a daily basis. And there are 30 plus deaths.
India, the world's second most populous nation, remains in deep crisis as hospitals and morgues are overwhelmed by the pandemic, with medicine and oxygen in short supply and strict limits on movement imposed in the country's largest cities.
The second wave of COVID-19 pandemic is causing a steep rise in the number of infections and posing a huge challenge for health experts and the government here. Experts have warned that the fight against the pandemic is far from over and have urged the people not to drop their guard against the deadly virus. Said Ali Safi, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Kyrgyzstan has accused Tajikistan of breaching a recent ceasefire that the two sides agreed on following Thursday's deadly border clashes. The Kyrgyzstan National Security Committee claimed that the Tajik military opened fire on houses in the southwestern border region of Batken. The committee said villagers were evacuated before the shooting began. Clashes between Kyrgyz and Tajik forces broke out after civilians along the border began fighting over a disputed water reservoir. The exchange of fire left more than 30 people dead and scores of others injured on the Kyrgyzstan side. Tajikistan also reported some injuries, but no deaths. The two sides announced a ceasefire later that day. Clashes over land and water are common occurrences in the region because the two Central Asian nations have a long disputed border. New protests have been held in Italy's capital, Rome, as tens of thousands of workers fear losing their occupation. More than 500,000 jobs have been lost in Italy since the start of the pandemic last year. Max Civilli has more.
The socioeconomic malaise that has been worsened by the COVID crisis is erupting at an unprecedented level everywhere in Italy. Many hundreds large and small-scale protests have been held across the country over the past months. On Wednesday, thousands of street vendors staged a protest against the city decision to stop the extension of their licenses. They blocked the capital's Ring Road and occupied the central Republic Square, as tens of thousands of itinerant street trading businesses are at risk of closure due to an EU directive on free trade.
In Italia, è stata...
Italy has been under attack since the EU introduced the Bolkestein Directive, which aims at establishing a single market for services. Our Parliament has already opposed the adoption of this provision.
La crisi totale.
We have been abandoned in these testing times. How dare they? The mayor wants to impose standards in Rome. She's killing us.
Also on Wednesday, pilots, flight attendants and other airline industry workers gathered in central Rome to stage a protest against a rescue plan to save the bankrupt former national airline Alitalia. The airline is running out of cash for fuel and salaries, and workers fear some 7,000 employees will be sacked if a buyout offer by a group of investors gets the green light from the government.
The government is not listening to our demands. We have not even been paid last month. That's how Alitalia special commissioners are treating us.
The Draghi government is not used to listening to workers' needs. I am afraid this executive can only make unpopular decisions.
Recently, Italy's parliament has overwhelmingly approved the government's European Union-funded pandemic recovery plan, worth 248 billion euros. Prime Minister Draghi has pledged the plan would address both the damage caused by COVID and the country's long-standing structural issues.
Italy is at a crossroads. There is the risk that the pandemic may turn into an unprecedented socio-economic crisis that will drag on for a very long time. But Italians also have the opportunity to use the funds from a vigorous stimulus package of the EU to relaunch employment and growth. It remains to be seen whether the country will succeed in this process. Max Civili, Rome.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Once every 100,000 years, gold is created from the collision of neutron stars. Mysterious gold instantly melted into humanity's desire, contained the magic which enabled civilizations to flourish and fueled the desire that made people venture across oceans. But why do we lust after gold? And does humanity own gold, or does gold own humanity? I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. For centuries, gold was the economic index which dominated the world before it lost to the dollar. But the 2008 financial meltdown has brought gold back from oblivion. Gold is now dominating the world once again, but why is it gold again? In 2008, gold woke up from its deep, dark sleep. As the dollar became unstable during the U.S. financial crisis, people rushed to gold. And in August of 2011, the twisted destiny recurred. The new gold rush started again. Pursuit has begun once again, and stay with us as we take a look into the history of gold from its glittering past to its sudden return.
Gold.
That is gold.
Kingai.
King or gold.
Gold.
With gold.
Gold.
In oro.
The oro.
Oro.
Into gold.
Sold gold.
Gold.
Gold price.
Gold mines. Gold is undervalued.
Currency, which reflects human instincts, is very much alive. Money gained humanity's passionate desire since its creation. Money was at the center of wars and economies. Its origin can be traced back to Mesopotamia. Thousands of years ago, Sumerians were the first ever to develop trade. Since then, many types of currency have appeared in history. Trading goods for goods appeared first. Grains, essential for everyone, were used as currency in many areas. As time passed, smaller objects were used for trading to facilitate easier transportation and exchange. Various metals became the new currency, as they were easily transportable and did not rot. But not all metals were permanently stable. In the end, gold, whose value was accepted consistently as a stable metal, became the best currency. Gold, which is evaluated by its weight and purity, has no exchange rate or nationality. Due to its high value, large trades were made possible with just small amounts of gold. It was the best currency that was accepted everywhere. In 700 BC, the kingdom of Lydia, which ruled Turkey, became the birthplace of the best invention in the history of currency. The capital of the kingdom was Sardis. It was the hub of the East and West, and as trading became important, the need for currency grew. Lydia dominated Asia Minor. It expanded its boundaries as the ancient empire, securing the trade route linking an area of over 2,700 kilometers. Lydia invented the world's first gold coins using their abundant resources of gold and built an affluent kingdom.
And this started with King Croesus of Lydia, which is a very famous name, and he really produced the first gold coins and used it particularly to pay soldiers and military people.
In the early 7th century BC, Lydians minted the world's first coins. Gold coins, which feature a lion's head, the symbol of Lydia, became the kingdom's representative export goods. As the world's first gold coins and the world's first empire currency, Lydia's coins spread through Asia Minor and Greece. They became a necessity for trade in the Mediterranean. Goods, art, people, and knowledge gathered in Lydia, and humanity's first retail businesses began. With a single shiny gold coin, people were able to buy horses or delicious food. It also reduced shopping time. A new world had opened up for humanity. But if the Lydians were the first to invent coins, the Greeks were the first to turn coin making into an art form. Each city imprinted its own unique symbols. They were the symbols of national strength. Greek coins circulated the Mediterranean through marine commerce. Gold coins brought revolutionary developments in commerce and became the foundation of civilizations. Education also developed quickly along with the coins. Five 500 years after the birth of gold coins, the currency revolution moved to Rome. Coins featuring the emperor's face, as well as other royalty, were widely used among laymen. As the territory of the Roman Empire expanded, the amount of gold attained through looting and mining grew exponentially. Consequently, the Romans issued more gold coins, and these coins strengthened the empire. Gold coins were what built the Roman Empire. In 395 AD, after the Roman Empire divided into two, Western Rome collapsed within the next 100 years. However, the surviving Eastern Rome continued to write history for another 1,000 years. Constantine the Great moved Rome's capital to Byzantium and founded the Byzantine Empire. Constantine the Great, who reunited Rome, declared freedom from religion and chose Sunday as a day of rest. He also issued a new gold coin called solidus. This is Byzant, the best currency. The Byzant, with a 98% purity, weighed 4.5 grams. bezant was the basic currency of the Middle Ages that everyone could trust and use. It was the longest surviving currency in history.
Really ran from about 500, well, really 300 AD, but 500 AD in Istanbul itself, and lasted for almost 1,000 years, really with the weight and the purity of it unchanged. There were some years when it was a problem, but it did last almost for 1,000 years, the Byzantine solidus. It was a 1,000-year coin, if you like.
The bezant was the revenue source to maintain a large army and the means of controlling the empire. That is why the bezant is called the dollar of the Middle Ages. The dollar of the Middle Ages surpasses today's dollar in terms of stability and value. While today's dollar faced a crisis within 100 years, the bezant survived for 1,000 years. The bezant was the partner that supported the kingdom for 1,000 years. The value of gold transcends time and space and gives faith to people. But there was a critical weakness even to gold, the best currency. There is a limit to the production of gold, and there are three ways to overcome the limit. One was to endure the lack of currency, and the other was to bring in gold from other regions through trade and loot. The last method was currency degradation, by making more coins with the same amount of gold. People began to deceive others by making new coins using clipped edges of existing coins.
And up until 1696, coins were struck onto a rough blank. So you used to be able to, if you were a very unscrupulous silversmith, you could clip the edges and get free silver. And so there were many laws that were passed to try and stop this. And in 1696, what they did was that they made sure that all the coins were circular with a milled edge. So that stopped the practice of coin clipping.
This is the origin of how the coin edges look today. Clipping of coin edges brought many problems. The value of currency fell, and prices began to inflate. New coins had to be issued to win people's trust. Sir Isaac Newton stepped up to solve all these problems.
And one of his big responsibilities was to prevent forgery. So one of the ways he did that was by making sure that all the coins had a milled edge round them, because if the edge is milled with little grooves, it's impossible to clip off a little bit of the coin.
The grooves on the coins that Newton made are used on today's coins as well. The grooves mark the human greed for gold. Gold, however, was never used as the main currency in the East. As the value of gold developed the currency system in the West, brass coins backed by the government played a similar role in the East. whether it be gold or a brass coin. If the receiver had trust in it, that was enough. People had faith in the government. The first coins in the East were made during the Jin Dynasty. They believed the sky was round and the land was square. So they made a round coin with a square hole in the middle. This shape became the basic shape of Eastern coins for 2,000 years. The trust of currency gave birth to the world's first paper money in China. Gyoza, issued in Buxong in 1023, was the first paper money. When Emperor Kublai Khan of the Yuan Dynasty mass-produced bozhou and circulated them through Eurasia, the era of paper currency began. Paper money was made of paper, but it ceased to be just ordinary paper. Kublai Khan is described as an alchemist in the travels of Marco Polo. Paper currency was like magic to the Westerners who were using gold coins. During the Yuan Dynasty, the government forcefully retained gold, silver, and copper, and with its guarantee, paper money was issued. With the circulation of paper money, less money was spent on producing coins, which led to a better financial status of the government, and thus led to a more active commerce. Replacing the gold with paper money opened up a new golden era in the East. At the end of the 15th century, gold had cast a spell on people and made them cross the oceans, risking their lives. But the lives of Europeans were also shaken up by gold. At the time, the population which had been devastated by the plague was bouncing back. Price of commodities was also increasing. Moreover, as gold and silver from the New World poured into Europe, prices soared uncontrollably. The price revolution of the 16th century began. Treasure from the New World created a large gap between the rich and the poor.
And this is at a time when that is much more than a week's earnings in the late. It's more like 2 weeks' earnings. So it is a lot of time to earn the smallest coin. And therefore ordinary people do not have gold coins. It is something for the rich to have.
Prices quadrupled and sextupled. First, landowners who received a consistent amount of rent went bankrupt. Farmers who didn't have money to rent land became wage laborers. On the other hand, the royal families and noblemen enjoyed an unprecedented extravagance. Gold instantly spread throughout European countries, and in its wake, only collapsed industries and financial crisis remained. Such was the curse of gold. The price revolution continued on for over 100 years without any resolution. It was the longest inflation in history. When commerce expanded and capitalism developed, a barter economy emerged. A system of an exchange of promissory notes for foreign currency began. 48 types of gold coins used in Europe in the 16th century were all exchangeable. Thus, financial innovation was propelled by the power of gold. In the early 19th century, gold faced a new era. Money was dependent upon the value of gold. A system of gold and money exchange emerged. Since then, history repeatedly introduced and discarded the gold standard. In 1819, England pegged the value of pounds to gold and circulated paper money that could be exchanged for gold at any time. By 1870, most countries had adopted the gold standard, and the pound, which could be exchanged for gold, became the key currency around the world.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
In the name of Allah, the most merciful, the most beneficent. Salaam alaikum wa rahmatullah, my dear brothers and sisters and lovely listeners. Thank you so very much for being with us on this episode of The Lantern, brought to you by IRIB English Radio. It's an honor and a pleasure, as always, to be with you guys today, where we're going to talk about, as usual, a short little story regarding a gardener, a dude who planted a rose. I loved his rose so very much. Kind of reminds me of Little Prince. With a cute little moral of the story to it. So without further ado, let's listen to the story real quick, and we're going to be right back, so stay with us. The title of today's story is The Rose Within. A certain man planted a rose and watered it faithfully, and before it blossomed, he examined it. He saw the bud that would soon blossom, but noticed thorns upon the stem, and he thought, how can any beautiful flower come from a plant burdened with so many sharp thorns? Saddened by this thought, he neglected to water the rose, and just before it was ready to bloom, it died. So it is with many people. Within every soul there is a rose. The godlike qualities planted in us at birth grew amid the thorns of our faults. Many of us look at ourselves and see only the thorns, the defects. We despair, thinking that nothing good can possibly come from us. We neglect to water the good within us. And eventually, it dies. We never realize our potential. Some people do not see the rose within themselves. Someone else must show it to them. One of the greatest gifts a person can possess is to be able to reach past the thorns of another and find the rose within them.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Right, so in life, we will, as human beings, constantly be in a state of limbo regarding whether we are good enough. Every human being feels it. But what's important, however, like every other aspect of life, is to create a balance, an equilibrium, a yin and yang regarding this matter. And Islam, as always, comes to the rescue and shows us the best way to establish that yin and yang for ourselves, as it does create balance in every other facet of our life. That's the whole objective of Islam. One could think, I can live my life without religion. I can try to be physically healthy, mentally healthy, and psychologically healthy. That's wonderful. Good on you for trying. But at the end of the day, as human beings, we often fail to create that perfect balance. And it's from my understanding and personal experience in life throughout these 20-something years that I've been living on God's green earth, that Allah, who knows me the best, knows what I need the best, and He can create the best balance for me. So that's the objective of Islam in a nutshell. For us to be ummatan wasata, something in the middle, the medium society. And Allah praises us for that. So basically, what is the yin and yang we can create for ourselves regarding the feeling that, am I ever going to be good enough, right? As human beings, we look at ourselves and we are given the choice to either focus on our thorns, focus on our spikes, focus on the fact that if anyone touches us, we're going to prick their fingers and make them bleed and hurt them. Or we can focus on the fact that, hey, look how beautiful I am. Look how, and by beauty, I don't just mean outer beauty, everyone can be beautiful on the outside, but because Allah has created us fi ahsan taqweem, in the best manner, what's really important is to develop that inner beauty that makes us radiate that aromatic fragrance that captivates the hearts, right? That comes from the inside. Or we can focus on that. We can focus on how everyone yearns to have a rose because it's so beautiful. It can give so much happiness and joy. It can bring so much liveliness into a room, whatever room it's placed in, right? And I think the closest concept I could think of regarding this matter is the concept of khawf and raja that exists within our religion. And Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, I find, has emphasized on it more than any. Khawf and raja basically means to have fear that, will Allah forgive my sins? Have I been the best Muslim, the best servant that I possibly could? Have I done enough to please my Lord, to be a good human being, to bring benefit and value to the places, the spaces I occupy, and to those around me? Have I been successful in touching their hearts and inspiring them to become better? And by becoming better, I mean getting closer to Allah. And I can only do that through my righteous actions. If I haven't made myself upright and upon the straight path, no matter how much I talk about Allah, people are going to see right through me. And they're going to be like, well, why don't you practice what you preach, right? And on the other hand, I have raja. I have hope that no matter, even if I have sinned, equivalent to all the sins of history, these are the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen, even if my sins have reached the skies and scraped the clouds, even if my sins are equivalent to all the grains of sand and all the drops of water, Allah's mercy, Allah's limitless forgiveness is way, 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 way more than all the sins of all the worlds. And that should give me hope. That should give me the strength to carry on. If I manage to focus on the goodness I can develop within myself through the limitless help of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, through that great almighty power that I choose to anchor myself on, ground myself with, then the sky is the limit. There's absolutely nothing I can't do once I keep that in mind. If I manage to create that balance within myself, that the only thing holding me down, weighing me down, is my sins, and the only thing I need to rely on, that beauty that I get is from the limitless source of beauty itself, which is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. My thorns are my sins, and my pros and my asset is my Allah, then life is perfect. Thank you so very much for being with me on this episode of The Lantern. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.